stars, perhaps, and the lords and ladies of television, maybe, and a few pop stars. But I guess we don't care much what they stand for. But we've certainly heard of Bruce Ruxton, the unopposed president of the RSL in Victoria for 21 years. He's known for what he says, and he's spread the RSL policies and thoughts to Moscow, London, Paris, Johannesburg, Canada, and all over Southeast Asia. He's a life member of the RSL, of course, and has its gold badge and its meritorious medal. It's a shame the South Australian State Congress, the RSL, has prevented his local colleagues from being here. Otherwise, they would have been. Now, what else? He's an MBE, an OBE, a member of the Order of Australia, a Naturalmont, he's a Chevalier of the Order of Merit of France, and holds the Legion of Honour. With all that, ladies and gentlemen, to speak on Australia's rich heritage, what are you going to do about it? Please welcome Bruce Ruxton.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I've got to get those openers changed. I find it a little bit embarrassing. But however, I've got a few things to say to you today. I just want to start off with the young generation, which is pretty important. Now, in the Sydney Press yesterday, and I don't know whether it was the Sun Herald or the Sunday Telegraph, they had quite a big article, front page and a double page inside, on young people and our military heritage and how they're sort of grasping it right now. Now, it's not only happening in Sydney or Melbourne or Adelaide, but it's happening in every town in Australia, no matter how small. The ANZAC services are quadrupling, even more than that, right round Australia. Now, they mightn't next week with Easter interfering. I'm just a bit worried about it, being Easter Tuesday and the extended holiday. But, however, it's happening right round Australia. It's very likely a reason for it. And you people in the media have helped, because we've gone through a lot of anniversaries over the past decade or more, very likely starting off with the bicentenary year in 1988. I just want to remind you all, that's 12 years ago, if you don't mind. Then, of course, there was 1990, the 75th anniversary of the landing at Gallipoli. 1993, the 75th anniversary of the ending of the worst Holocaust in human history, World War One, and the return to Australia of an unknown soldier. 1995, of course, was the Australian Remembers Years, and I see we had a badge on our table today. That was a wonderful year for the World War II veterans, a wonderful year, and no, we won't see that again. Last October was the 100th anniversary of the commencement of the Boer War. Now, a lot of Australians don't know that in the Boer War, of course, there were separate colonies, South Australia, Victoria, etc., sent their soldiers over there. We had the third highest casualties of all wars after World War One and World War Two. Then came South Africa, higher than Korea or Vietnam. And so even 100 years today, going back, they'll be fighting in South Africa. And so it's all of these anniversaries and may have been stemming young people on. And they started to ask questions in schools where school teachers, and I hope there's not too many here today, have been a little bit hesitant about talking about our heritage or our history because it seems to have been wiped out of the curricula of schools. And at any rate, this pressure has been brought about. Now, I go to schools averaging at least once a week. At least once a week, I go to a school somewhere. All schools, state, government, Catholic and independent schools. And I get the same reception there. Even primary school kids, the questions they ask, they seem to be right on the ball. In fact, in our dawn service in Melbourne, and I might add that last year was the biggest crowd ever at the dawn service in Melbourne, with all these young families turning up, Well, a lot of the schools are busing kids into the dawn services now, busing them in, so we're getting this great spread of young people. We put on a breakfast in St Kilda Road, the RSL, and we served 8,000 of them last year. That wasn't a bad start, really. Now, having said that, with all of this knowledge about our military history, I just want to go through some of the battles, and I'll start off with Anzac. Now, there are three misconceptions that have been built in over the years about Anzac and Gallipoli. One, we were the only ones there. Now, we weren't. 28,000 British soldiers died at Gallipoli, 13,000 French, a little over 8,000 Australians, 6,000 Indians, and a little over 3,000 New Zealanders. So we weren't the only ones there, I can assure you. The second misconception is that the troops landed at Anzac Cove, and it's a small cove. I can't equate it with one of your beaches, but I can where I come from, a seaside suburb in Melbourne, at Beaumaris. Just north of Beaumaris is Black Rock. I go through Black Rock every morning to go to work. There's a bay called Half Moon Bay, and it's bigger than Anzac Cove, so you've got to get it into there. It's only a small cove. And the misconception is that we fought across the beaches and up those immediate cliffs on the 25th of April. Well, we did do that, but we did more. We got in further that day than the whole 9 months of the Gallipoli campaign. In fact, over three ridges, nearly 1,000 feet high, and the first ridge nearly a mile in, holly-like scrub, it just rips, still does if you get caught amongst it. And one patrol nearly got through to the Dardanelles, because when they went back there in 1919, there was a platoon, a circle of skeletons, where they died to the last man, and the water was only about 200 metres down further from them of the Narrows. So they nearly got to the Narrows on the first day. But Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, he stemmed the retreating Turks. He put his hand up and said, "You stop. You must die here, but we haven't any ammunition. You will fix your bayonet and you will die for your country here." And it was that order that turned things around. Now, I want to explain why, because things were disorganised at Anzac. Like a lot of things, which they did in World War II, fortunately, they took into account currents, moon, you know, and the whole lot. And tides. But at Anzac, when they were rowed ashore, and they were rowed ashore in big whalers, they were only boys 14, 15, 16 and 17 rowing them, boys seamen and midshipmen of the Royal Navy, just kids. And of course the currents took them down about a kilometre from where they should have landed. Now that kilometre made all the difference, because a kilometre where they should have landed, there were no cliffs, it was open go. But here they were in front of this wall of high rock, and up there a feature called the Sphinx. If you look at it today, there it is, the head of the Sphinx from Egypt. It's incredible. And so they got disorganised, and the soldiers lost their units, they lost their companies and platoons, yet they were still advancing inland with all their equipment. I call it one-man wars. They were just marching forward, if they were taking on the whole war on their own. And that made them get in so far. Now, the highway to the war was a V-shaped valley called Shrapnel Valley. Using the old language, just about a mile in from the beach to the foot of the first ridge, which was Monash Gully. And that was the road where the supplies went up, food, water, etc., where Simpson went up with his donkey three times in a day, they tell me he used to traverse it. Think of it, a mile up and a mile back, and do that three times. Shrapnel by name and shrapnel by nature. Water up and wounded out. And of course, up on that first ridge where they retreated to, the first ridge was where it all happened. from Chanuk Bay to the north, the highest point on the Gallipoli Peninsula, where the New Zealanders and the Gurkhas had won and lost so many times, the historians said that the ground was blood red. And then down Battleship Ridge and Rhododendron Ridge to the neck. Now, you may remember that film on Gallipoli. I think it was made by Rupert Murdoch. NEK, the neck, is where the light horse regiments were decimated. No horses, of course, are being used as infantry. And I'll explain this to you again. And it goes right down to the first ridge, right down to Lone Pine in the south. Now, there's a road runs along the ridge at the top, only a narrow bitumen road. And you've got to pull over to let a car pass. It's bedlam up there Anzac Day with all those buses and things. You've got no idea. It's incredible. But however, what happened on the round about the 6th of August 1915, a huge attack took place. It was to relieve the pressure on the Kiwis up at Chanuk Bay, and it went right along the ridge. And all the Australians along the ridge had to play their part. And if I'm standing at the neck now, looking inland, the way down there is Anzac Cove. You can see how they got up there, goodness knows, way down there, and the blues, a GEC behind. Looking forward, one can see a memorial in a cemetery, and that's Baby 700 Cemetery. There's a famous Australian buried in there, or famous name anyway. His father was Peter Lawler of Eureka fame, and that was Captain Lawler who's buried there. They tell me with his sword and all. That's the way that goes. And looking half across a ravine over here, one can see Quinn's Post. Now, Quinn was named after Quinn, who was a Major Quinn. He was a fabulous infantry officer. A terrifically brave Australian. He had every quality of a leader. He's buried way down there at the Shrapnel Valley Cemetery. He got mortally wounded and died down near the beach. Now, Quinn was 25 years of age, by the way. And the trenches were 5 metres apart. 5 metres apart for 9 months. For 9 months. That's how close they could hear the Turks talking and Vicky Verse. And then down the road further, the next cemetery we come to is Steele and Courtney's Post. And that's where Jacka won the first Victoria Cross in World War One. It was absolutely bedlam at Courtney and Steele's Post. And Jacka cleared a trench that had been taken by the Turks. He cleared them out himself with his bayonet. And it was a great feat of arms. The road drops down to Johnson's Jolly. Nothing jolly about Johnson's Jolly. I could take any of you people in this room now into the bush behind the cemetery at Johnson's Jolly, and you can kick up the bones of soldiers. Easy. And then it rises up to Lone Pine. And so that's in Lone Pine in that August offensive. That was our one great success, where they stormed the Turkish trenches. And they had to shoot downwards because the Turks had logs across them, if you remember some of these paintings that you've seen about. And they had a great victory. There were 7 Victoria Crosses won at Lone Pine one morning, the greatest number of Victoria Crosses since the Zulu War of 1879. And I think all of you have seen that film about Rorke's Drift called Zulu, where 11 were won. And so that's what happened on the 6th and 7th of August. Now, getting back to the neck, where the light horse regiments were, the bases of that film, there were no telephones or radio, unfortunately. And at 04:30 hours, they were lined up in rows of 150, four rows. At 04:30 hours, the whistle blew, and out went row one, and they were shot back into the trench. Then row two, then row three. And they stopped row four. And they sent a runner down, if you remember in the film, down to the beach, to the staff, to stop row four. The British got the blame in the film, but they get the blame for everything, you know that. But before the runner got back, he just missed them. because the left flank said, look, the right flank's moving forward. And as the historians once again said, as if attracted to the bodies of their mates like steel to a magnet. And away went row four. And so that was a tragedy of the neck. And some of the epitaphs on the tombstones. There's one up at the neck which is very sad. And I quote, his last words, goodbye, Cobber, God bless you. Close the inverted comma. And there it, sad, he was age 22, that man. And down at Lone Pine, there's a 16-year-old soldier from Western Australia, Private Hugh O'Donnell of the 11th Battalion, age 16. And the epitaph said, my little Anzac hero who came here to do or die, mother. A couple of rows over, a 17-year-old, and I might add there's a lot of 17-year-olders. It says, I will cry for you, my son, until the end of time, your loving mother. And so I just thought I'd just talk about the ridge and about some of the other battles at Gallipoli. You see, the big battle was down at Cape Helles. That was where the big war was to be staged. Anzac was a diversion. And across the Narrows, near the ancient city of Troy, the French landed as another diversion, because the British army went into action at Cape Helles, and it was very brutal. A ship called the River Clyde, an old British freighter, was beached. It would have been the first landing ship infantry in history. And it had its sides cut out to be pushed out, big paddles, and gangplanks out of the horizontal to let the troops out. Now, the first out were the Royal Dublin Fusiliers. And they moved from that ship into a cemetery that's right on the beach, right on the beach. It was murder, because up there on the top of the hill is an ancient Roman fort, still there, where the 2,000 years old. It's an old part of the world we're talking about. Raining death down the slope with machine guns. You can imagine a British Army Sergeant Major there. Come on, move out, move out, move out. And they were going straight to their death. As the historians once again said, the sea was just blood red. And one sailor got the Victoria Cross for getting out under fire and pushing the bodies off the gangplank to let them out. And so it was a dastardly experience there. But however, their plan was to take a little town called Krithia. Now, there's a book printed called The White Gurkhas. It's about the Australians, because the British Army were decimated and they brought the 2nd Brigade down from Anzac Cove, say 7 miles, by barge. That was the 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th Battalions. And they went into action almost immediately, lining up in one battalion rows. Say there were 600 of them left after Anzac. And 600 would go off, take off and charge across this open agricultural land. Very old, very likely been tilled for thousands of years. And of course the casualties were enormous. 2,700 Australians in a matter of 30 minutes were dropped to the ground. With the British Army up there yelling out to them, don't go, you're going to be slaughtered. And these are the sort of things that were happening. One British staff captain choking with emotion as he saw the Australians advancing forward. And so we've had a lot to be proud of about Gallipoli. Sure, it took a great waste of life. But I want to talk about the third misconception. It was Churchill's idea, and of course it was no good. And he did the right thing. Being a Westminster Parliament, not like some of the other parliaments round, if you know what I mean. He resigned and he went to France. But I went to a military historians conference in Ankara in 1987, and they came from around the world, and they were unanimous that Churchill's idea was, it was a beauty. If it had come off, World War I would have been shortened by 2 years and saved millions of lives. Millions. But the military bungled it. And there is an excuse for the military too, because it was the greatest seaborne landing in history up until that date. They had no precedent to work on. And of course the logistics were absolutely bungled. From Egypt, from Alexandria, they came up and they landed shelves down there with no guns and guns up there with no shelves. They forgot soldiers needed water, all of this sort of thing. There was a logistic hopeless mess they got themselves into. And consequently, that was one of the main reasons why the campaign did not come off properly. If you go there and study the place, and you read books about from both sides, there's one thing I believe comes into one's mind, and that is that if there'd been one great further push in December of 1915, just before they evacuated, they would have won. It would have cost a lot of casualties, but the Turkish army had just on had it, which they didn't know, of course. And so that was a tragedy of Gallipoli. But however, leaving that place, by the way, if you haven't been there, go there, please. It's a fascinating place, Turkey, for all of you, no matter what age, go there. Istanbul, it's a great city. I'd sooner go there than Rome or Paris, I can tell you now. And it's not because of the belly dancers either. But however, it's an interesting place. It's true east meets west. And Turkey's such an old country. From the Çanakkale down to the Syrian border, it's a very old part of the world. Past the ancient city of Troy and the Trojan Wars. And the Mediterranean is clean and beautiful. All around the rest of the Mediterranean, on the African side, the plastic bottles go out a mile. It's awful. The Spanish, French and Riviera, have you been there lately? No, for Bruce, would you compare them to our beaches? And in Greece, Salonika, you can walk on the water. That's how crooked it is. So go to Turkey. You've got nostalgia. The countryside looks like Australia, strangely. It's got a lot going for it. So please, now leaving there and going to Paris is not that far in our standards, and taking a bus from Paris, it only takes a few hours to get into that awful area of northern France. Now I go there fairly frequently, and to me, because I'm interested in it, I suppose, it's enchanting. The waste of life, 50,000 Australians died in northern France, 50,000, 1 million soldiers of the British Empire died in northern France. 1 million. It's hard to fathom. But going up north, you come to the ancient city of Reims. I'm sorry about this Fitzpatrick travel talk, but however, we get up to Reims, the ancient cathedral where the French kings used to be crowned, and you veer right, you go to a place called Verdun. What a terrible place Verdun was. Both the German and French armies had worked on a way of winning the war by attrition. It was just staggering. And say 5 or 6 square miles, 2 million men. 2 million. And of course, in the end, the French army mutinied. And that could have been bad news for the British armies up north. Very bad news. France could have collapsed. It could have been a catastrophe. And so, Haig, and he's been ridiculed, of course, he started an offensive on the 1st of July, 1916, the Somme Offensive, of which 60,000 British soldiers were dropped to the ground on the first day. 60,000, of which 20,000 were killed. The Germans brought 100 divisions up from Verdun, so He won that argument. Verdun was saved and the French army regrouped, but at a terrible cost. And so we see this awful battles that took place in northern France and southern Belgium and Flanders. And again, ladies and gentlemen, it's an interesting place to go to, even though the carnage, and you go to Pozieres where the Australians were, at the windmill site, of the plaque on the ground, more Australians have died here than any other place on earth. So that makes you think. And of course, you go further north of Fromelles, which was a disaster. The only disaster the Australians took part in World War One was at Fromelles, where they had to charge over open ground with German pillboxes studded. They're still there, everywhere, and of which thousands were killed at Fromelles. Absolutely slaughter. Then, of course, across the border, and all the way from Armentières, which is right on the border, through Plugger Street, and right through Messines, and up to the Menin Gate in Ypres. Ypres, Leper, whatever you like to call it, Ypres. And there, these battles of Ypres took place. It was awful. There's a Belgian businessman I know. He's the chairman of the Last Post Association at Ypres, because the bugles play there every night at 8 o'clock. And they've done that since 1927. Even during the war, the Germans let the bugles blow, except for the last year of the war. I think there was fighting around the town again. And this, he's got to pay these firemen who blow the bugles, and he told me there is no place anywhere in the world that's more British than around Ypres. That's what he said. It was a walled city, and one of the gates was the Menin Gate. Now, a very famous architect, a British architect by the name of Sir Reginald Blomfield, designed the Menin Gate. It was opened around about 1927 by King Leopold of the Belgians. And on the Menin Gate, the unknown soldiers of the British Army, every regiment of the British Army, every battalion of the Australian, Canadian, New Zealand, South African and Indian armies. There's about 150,000 names. And he didn't build it big enough. He wasn't told, because 5 miles up the road towards Passchendaele, and there's a nice sounding name for the worst Holocaust on earth at Passchendaele, is the Tynecott Cemetery, the biggest British Commonwealth War Cemetery in the world. 12,000 known graves and another 80,000 unknown soldiers around the walls. See, what happened was that a burial soldier, now you don't go down too deep if you're in the infantry when you're buried, you've got to be picked up later on. You don't go down 6 feet. You bury a soldier, and subsequent bombardments blew that grave to smithereens and lost, I suppose you could say, the ground in Flanders would be well manured, I suppose one can say, well fertilised, unfortunately. And so we got that sad business around Tynecott. Tynecott, because the Northumberland Fusiliers reckon the farmhouses around look like Tyneside cottages. So they called it the Tynecott Cemetery. Please go there sometime. It's so interesting, that part of the world in Flanders, sad, the polygon wood, Messines, etc. It's just the number of men that died there. It's incredible. And of course, we're talking about unknown soldiers, and of course, all those that were killed that had known graves. There were cemeteries studded everywhere. So I just thought you'd like to hear about something about that. Now, look, all of you in the press, you know that welfare doesn't make the headlines. The RSL would be very likely the biggest welfare organisation in Australia. I'll back that in. But no one knows about that. It's not a headline material. It's the national policies of the RSL that are headline material. The national policies, they're the ones that get you into neon lights. They do all sorts of things for you. And strangely, most of them have been around since 1916. Not Ruxton or Garland or someone, or Bailey, not us at all. They've been around since 1916. Let's have a look. The constitutional monarchy and the Australian flag, 1916. The defence of Australia, 1916. In fact, the RSL supported those referenda in World War One, which were subsequently lost. The anti-Bolshevik vote was taken in 1917 and it's still on the books. I put it to my conference, you still want this on the books? I said, leave it there and get on with something else. They give me straight orders. And then 1921, immigration. Now, there are some new ones. Land rights. We've got our policies on land rights and a few other things now. Those men who came back from World War One wouldn't have thought anyone would have rocks between their ears to give Australia away to the Aborigines in 1992, in the year 2000. Now, if you haven't heard me, I'll repeat that. There are a few new policies. Now, it's been proved conclusively, or we think so, by a multitude of public opinion polls and some referenda, that the overwhelming majority of Australians are on the side of the RSL with these national policies. And I'll tell you why. Because we convey community attitudes. Now, in Victoria, the smallest of states, I've got 380 sub-branches. 380. Nearly every town would have an RSL. They know what's going on in the town. When I go around before an election, they tell me who's going to win and who's going to lose. They've never been wrong. Because they convey public opinion. They hear what's going on. And so we get onto these, say there's 12, say, contentious issues, which you people in the press like to latch onto now and again. Say there's 12. As I said, it's been proved conclusively that the overwhelming majority of Australians agree with us. Now, if you disagree, say, with three, it's also been proved that you become a minority viewpoint on those three, on those three particular issues. You see, one of the big problems today is that we're living in a time when the minority viewpoint is being steamrolled, bulldozed and ramrodded over the majority viewpoint. And I think most people would agree with that. We're listening to the minority viewpoint all the time. In a democracy, the minority viewpoint must be heard, otherwise we're not democratic. But it should never rule. I was taught the majority rule when I went to school. And so the other thing I'd like to convey to you too now, right now, before I say anything more, we live in a sad time because the parliaments around Australia, that is the each state, both houses, and the federal parliament, both houses, are groaning with non-entities and mediocrities. That's what's happening. Groaning with them. It's sad. And by the way, I include that stinking little parliament in the ACT, all right? So you'll see the minority viewpoint. The president tells me you've got Tim Costello coming up. I hope you enjoy your lunch. Well, what else can I say about him? I said to the president before, he's a Baptist and he wants to be the Pope. That's what he wants. But however, so we've got these issues that cause... Now, let's get on to land rights. First of all, I want to start with a little story. I was invited to Canberra to attend a dinner in Parliament House to pay back 50 Torres Strait Islanders' difference pay from the war. Now, I was in the 2nd 25th Battalion, a Queensland unit of the 7th Division, and we had more Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders in our battalion than most, and they were all good soldiers, a lot of them. Good soldiers. Any of my friends down there will remember the Aborigines in the army, they all did a good job. But, for some reason or another, 50 and the Torres Strait must have been put under the Native Servicemen's Act of New Guinea, which was down money. Some bungling public servant, I suppose. And it was payback time. Now, they're going to get the difference pay. Now, I'll explain it to you in a moment. One bloke got $30,000 difference pay. Now, that made me stop and think. By the way, in a moment, I had a lot of time to think that night because no one was talking to me. But however, I was on 3 shillings a day after I had a lot of money to my mother, poor old mum. I reckon I'd have to be in the army somewhere around about 800 years. $30,000. Tom Blamey wouldn't have got $30,000 in two world wars, and he ended up a field marshal. But however, this bloke got $30,000. Now, the plane was a bit late. I got to Parliament House a bit late. Now, I didn't need a guide to be taken where the reception was. I could hear them. 250 white do-gooders out of the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. That was the biggest cultural shock I've ever had in my life. Get all them together. Anyway, I just followed the noise. You know, all slurping it up out of the public trough. Using the old adage, the more you drink, the more you save. Anyway, I get to the door. Of course, there's dead quietness when I... The silence went like that when I fronted. I said, carry on. Anyway, I sat down, had to put up with no one talking to me. Well, it was a crook dinner anyway. Anyway, then there were the toasts. Now, if you drank a full glass at every toast, you would have got whacked. It was Perkins' turn. He got up to reply to a toast and he nailed me. He said, what's more, Ruxton? That woke me. He said, not only are we going to get our land rights, he said, what's in here, in the mind? But we're going to change the names of Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth and Hobart to Aborigine names. I couldn't contain myself any longer. I yelled out at him, why don't you change your own bloody name to an Aborigine name? That went over like a lead balloon. Matter of fact, the most awful part of the night, and this is a real tearjerker. After the dinner, the minister said to me, Ruxton, he said, that's the last time I'm inviting you to Parliament House for dinner. Isn't that awful? But however, now he's at it again. I thought the remarks made by Charlie Perkins last week or the week before were outrageous. Outrageous. Wanting burn, baby, burn. And buildings to be burnt and cars to be torched. If there's any building to be burnt, why can't it be his own $2 million house? Where did he get that money from? All out of the public trough, of course. It's just wrong to think that that man can carry on the way. He should be charged with inciting a riot. You people try saying the same thing and see where you get. You'd have a pair of handcuffs on you in no time. I just think it's wrong that he gets away with it all the time. I just feel sad that that man goes, he gets on the BBC, there was 143 million audience were told not to come to this country unless you want to see buildings burn, babies burn, the whole lot. That's terrible, terrible coming from an Australian. At any rate, I've had a few swipes at him. I hope to be able to see him personally shortly. You're going to get the biggest bombardment he's ever had. Mind you, I don't think he likes me that much. I just want to say just a couple of other things, if I may. The bicentenary. I want to get back to 1988. Now, as an Australian, I felt proud that I was alive to go into the bicentenary. I thought I was really proud about it, but the smile got wiped off my face very early. Now, you may have forgotten this, but the agenda was taken over in every daily around Australia, nearly full pages in the thinking pages, near the editorials, by two groups of people, the Aborigines and what they haven't got in 200 years, and then the Republicans started to get out of the woodwork. Let's have a look. The Aborigines, led by old Blue Eyes from Tasmania, Mansell. If he's an Aborigine, I'm a Zulu. He knows it. And of course, then we came on to the Republicans. Two are dead. I don't speak ill of the dead, because I told them before they died. I think I've been accused of killing them. Professor Manning Clark, oh dear, oh bloody dear. A tired old man from the far left with a great big chip on his shoulder. And then his mate, Donald Horne, he's still about. Another tired old man from the far, far left with a mountain range on his shoulder. And then there was that tired old tart from Sydney, the greatest exponent of the Queen's English in this country that none of the Queen's subjects could ever understand. If you don't believe me, buy one of his books. If you get past page one, you're a Rhodes Scholar. I'm talking about the departed Nobel Prize winner for literature, Patrick White. A tired old nasty, nasty, nasty man from the far, far, far left with another mountain range right wrapped round him. Oh, he was a nasty bloke. I said to him, well, I said to Clark too before he died, I said, Manning, if you go any further left, you'll fall over a cliff. I said to Patrick White, I said, Patrick, why do you knock the royals all the time for you? You're a royal yourself. He said, what do you mean? I said, you're the biggest queen in Australia. Don't dispute it with me. Don't dispute it with me. And so I'd like to just conclude by saying this. I took part in the Constitutional Convention. I was elected on in Victoria. I spent the most miserable 2 weeks that one could ever spend in Canberra. Any time if you're in Canberra for 2 weeks is too long. The best part of Canberra is leaving it, you know that. At any rate, it was 2 weeks amongst all these idiots. I've just found it unbelievable. The Perkinses, the Pat O'Shanes. She's a magistrate in Sydney, as you know. I tell you what, I'd hate to get caught riding a bike on a pushback and on a footpath and go before her. I reckon I'd get life. Lois O'Donoghue, you can have her too. So I had this horrible time in Canberra. But however, I'm pleased about the result, not so much about Victoria. Yeah, old Tim Costello, he'll be putting his chest out again. He can't help himself or his brother. However, I just want to say this in conclusion, that we have a wonderful system of government in this country. Why change it? Now, it's a stale argument about the Australian head of state. It's a chronic... That's the only reason to change. Something's wrong. To wreck the freest country on earth. You've only got to ask Republicans 2 questions. And that is, what country on earth that is a republic, including the United States, is freer than Australia? They can't answer. 2, what peoples on earth that live in a republic, including the United States, are freer than Australians? It's absurd to try and even think about it. It's absurd. And consequently, I went along with the Memorandum and Articles of Association of the RSL, which clearly define that the Queen is our head of state. And I wasn't going to be the first president to buck that, I can assure you. I do hope that the future is going to be settled down, but it doesn't look like it will. Now, that's all I've got to say, Mr. President. I just close by, we've been talking about a lot of sinners. Now, walking up the Strand a couple of years ago in London, outside one of those ancient churches, there was a big banner. You see banners outside churches sometimes. Come inside and pray, the Lord's arriving Easter Monday or whatever. This one said, if you have finished sinning, come inside and pray. And someone had written underneath it, if you haven't, my telephone number is 9528311. Thank you.
Aid shall not weary them. Questions now from the media. Would you please give your organisation as well as your name? Thank you.
Mr. Ruxton, Rex Jury from the Advertiser. I've got 2 questions.
Your former editor's a good mate of mine, Peter Blunden. Do you know him?
I know him. Yeah, he's a mate of mine too.
He's a good bloke.
Yeah, I've had a drink with him on occasions. He hasn't finished sinning either. 2 questions. 200 metres from here, there's a Boer War memorial on the corner of North Terrace and King William Street. Breaker Morant's name doesn't appear on it. Should it? That's the first question.
Oh,
Just a minute. I haven't finished. And I'd like your reasons. The second question is, should David Irving be allowed into Australia?
Should the what?
David Irving be allowed into Australia.
Let's take question one about Breaker Morant. Rule one, if you're going to do the wrong thing, you don't get caught. You know, from Richard Pratt down, you don't get caught. That's a crime. You know, we'll be having Ned Kelly on the monument too, besides Breaker Morant. What we do in this country, we seem to laud people. He murdered prisoners of war in cold blood, Morant. It's like Kelly, I think he knocked off about 7 policemen. Do we still reckon he's the greatest Australian? No, his name shouldn't be on the memorial. The Serbians, they shouldn't have come here in the first place, sir. And the RSL told Ruddock that he was stupid. It was quite obvious there was going to be trouble about getting them out again. Fancy bringing people 12,000 miles, and you all remember this, they didn't want to come. Now that's important, look back in your papers. They did not want to come here. I knew it was only a temporary business, but of course then, I don't know, the silverfish get in. I believe that they should return now to their country, and I hope that after those people have been up in Port Hedland for a while that they'll be off. No, out, sir. Can I be any clearer than that? Yes, sir.
Bruce, two questions. Christopher Gelly. Who do you blame for the carnage and the disaster of Gallipoli? You said not Winston Churchill. Do you make up completely for the disaster and debacle of Gallipoli with the smoothness of the East Timor operation?
I would think that all the landings in World War II and subsequent landings would have learnt from Gallipoli. It was a military logistic disaster, and someone should be put to blame for that. Now, as I said to you earlier, there could have been a reason, a valid reason, about the military making errors. They had 1 month to organise the biggest seaborne landing in history to that time. From the 18th to the 23rd of March, when the Royal Navy and the French Navy had a retreat from the Narrows, they couldn't get through. The idea was, you've got the Black Sea up there, then there's a narrow stretch of water like a big river called the Bosphorus. Then it opens up into a huge sea, I equate with Port Phillip Bay in Victoria, called the Sea of Marmara. Then it narrows again, and it comes out of Chinakali in the Aegean Sea. Now, their idea was to get through the Narrows into the Sea of Marmara and bombard Constantinople, which was Istanbul. Now, they couldn't do it. It was mined and big ships went down. It was a terrible defeat. They had to get out. So from that moment, from the 18th to the 23rd of March to the 25th of April, they had a month to organise, and they mucked it. They didn't think of currents, as someone said before. These young boys rowing, the currents just took them down. All of that should have been worked out, but it wasn't. There were some bad generals at Gallipoli. Hunter Weston's one that comes to mind. He was down at Cape Helles. He slaughtered his own army down there. There's no doubt about that. Ian Hamilton was not the right man for the Gallipoli campaign. He was certainly a wrong commander-in-chief. I suppose you look over the... there were good and bad generals in the British Army and the Australian Army in two world wars. So we can't always blame one side, but that logistics caused the catastrophe at Gallipoli. Badly planned, and if they got the guns and the shells together, it might have made all that difference since they landed in the right place. And what was the other question, sir?
Timor.
Oh, East Timor. Well, it was. We had the ships, and we didn't have the enemy as such really causing bother, if one can put it that way. So it was a fairly quiet landing because they weren't armed to the teeth like we found in Normandy or Gallipoli or whatever. But the East Timor landing went over well, and I think the general, General Cosgrove, would be the greatest PR man I've ever known. He's great. And I reckon he's really made Australia look good in the eyes of the world. You look like Laurie Oakes. I know you're not. Yes.
Mr. Ruxton, Paul Starrick from the Advertiser. Two questions. Firstly, I just wanted to repeat one of Rex's on David Irving.
Oh, David Irving.
Whether you thought he should be.
No, I think he's a rat bag. But, however, I don't know how far you take democracy. Did we allow him in? This is did we knock people because they got stupid views, or do we let all of us make up our own minds? I think very likely that's the safest way. I don't agree with the man, but I just wonder whether not allowing him into the country is the answer.
And the second one, I was just wondering whether you can foresee a situation in the future where Australia could become a republic, where perhaps there would be a need to change the RSL's view and reflect what some would argue is the sentiments of younger Australians.
All right, I take your point. The inevitability, inevitable. You know the two inevitable things, taxes and death. I don't know whether I'm not like that. I fight to the bitter end. When Australians, if they're ever going to vote on a president, everyone gets a vote. And they know what catastrophes that's going to cause their parliament. I think they'll change their minds. They haven't been told. It'll be the finish of the Westminster system of parliament. The president will be more powerful than the prime minister, because the prime minister gets his job by the votes of the parliamentary party of which he belongs to. The other one's going to get the votes from everybody, so he's going to be more powerful. We could be leading to a disastrous situation in my book. I hope it doesn't come about. By the way, I think Kim Beazley's got to alter his mind. You know what he wants to do? He wants to talk to his old man and get a bit of political nous. All right with you? His old man's got plenty, and Kim's not using it. All right? Yes, sir. Oakes.
I wish I was Laurie Oakes from the Bulletin, because I don't get his pay packet, but I, in fact, am Robert Main from the Bulletin. Do you think that Australia in the foreseeable future will face the threat of another invasion? And if so, from which country?
Well, that's often said, why spend all this money on defence? I believe our main worry is mainland China. Now, I'm going to stick to that. Forget Indonesia. It's mainland China is what I keep thinking about. Now, you might hoo-ha it, but you've asked me. I think China will be the worry in the future. You see, with Indonesia, I believe if you go out there with a microphone and ask someone in the street, who's our enemy, they'll say Indonesia. I think that's bad. I'll tell you why. Here we are in a country, using the old measurement again, 12,000 miles around the coast, 12,000, 3 million square miles of area, with 19 million people. Just across, if you're going to Singapore in a jumbo and you leave the Northwest Cape, you see Indonesia. That's how close it is. Now, the demographers have said that there'll be 200 million people there by the year 2000. Well, they were dead right. There's over 200 million. And there'll be 300 million there by the year 2050. And we've still got 19 million people. I reckon we've got to start being more friendly with them. We should be buying more of them, particularly in the oil business. There are oil fields in Indonesia. Instead of going to the Arabs, I think we should be going closer to home. And I think we should be helping them to try and formulate a solid democratic society. But mainland China, with over 1 billion people, that worries me. I can only say that.
Do we have any more? Do we have any more?
Mr. Mansell said we can call you Mr. Zulu.
What did Mr. Mansell say?
We can call you Mr. Zulu.
I didn't hear that. I'm, One of my problems is I'm partially deaf.
Now, Mr. Mansell said we can call you Mr. Zulu. But now my question is, the submarines, there's been a lot of controversy about them. Do you think it's money well spent?
Well, I don't know. I'm just a layman like you are when it comes to submarines, but I wouldn't have gone over there to get them built anyway. I think that, or designed anyway, I think that the Australian manufacturers here, they'd be on the ball, but where were they designed in Sweden? Well, they never been to a war. How would they know? I just don't understand. You want to take on a country that's been to war using submarines. I think it's been a really bad exercise in waste of money. I hope they can rectify. They tell me that the HMAS Collins looks like being all right. I hope so. We need them. We need them. Any further questions? You all done?
All done.
Righto. Well, thanks a lot, everybody. I hope you don't leave here. I should have made a warning earlier. If you don't like me, I should have said this right at the beginning. If you don't like me and you're still eating, you should have stopped because you'd choke. I hope there's not too many. Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
You won't choke on this, I hope, but I don't know whether your taste runs to St. Hugo, Coonawarra, Cabernet Sauvignon in a magnum.
Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yes. So if you don't like it, I'll keep it, but thank you very much indeed, Bruce Ruxton.